You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 239 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you as usual in different locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion, Seattle Seahawks.
Hello.
Hello. And I had an intro all scheduled if the Sounders lost. I was thinking it through in my head. They were down 2-0. Okay, but I'm going to do it really quick.
Okay.
Hello, and welcome to episode 239 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by Pagliacci. I'm Tristan Caracino, coming to you from Renton, Washington. And, ladies and gentlemen, I would love to introduce to you, to follow up on his prediction that this would be the best sports week in Seattle history. That's right, ESPN's own Kevin Pelton.
Oh, no. Look, first off,
I wish I didn't stumble over some of those words. If the Sounders would have lost, I wouldn't have stumbled over a single word.
True. I never said that, first off. But number two, it was looking that way in about the 70th minute there.
I really love that you calling it the best sports week in Seattle history is synonymous with having an awful sports week now.
It really is now. I mean, the Huskies did beat like number two Kansas that week. It wasn't all bad. The listener, Michael Dodd, did shout this out on Twitter. I feel like I must have missed Kevin proclaiming on the podcast something about how great of a Seattle sports week this weekend was shaping up to be. But Seattle Sounders saved it. We got a toast to this. And boy, do we have something to toast with this week.
It's a doozy.
Because it is the Fremont barrel-aged B-Bomb 2020 release. Bum-ba-da-bum. It is here.
Do you want me to read about the B-Bomb this year? Are you ready to? I can do it. Hold on.
You already have your bottle open, and I've got to figure out the trick of cutting through the wax to actually get the bottle open.
Just do it. Get a bottle opener and get in there. There's still a lip to attach to. Okay, you ready? 2020 B-Bomb Imperial Winter Ale aged in bourbon bales. This year's release of B-Bomb
That's
is aged
barrels.
In... That's exactly what I said.
You said bales?
No, I didn't. Go back, rewind the tape. This year's release of B-Bomb is aged in 8 to 12-year-old American oak bourbon barrels and is a blend of 9, 12, and 24-month-old barrel-aged winter ale. B-Bomb achieves distinct bourbon, oak, cacao, leather, toffee, and dark coffee notes from its extended barrel aging and barrel blending. Each barrel contributes a different note, and combining each barrel to create a coherent tone is a distinct art and true pleasure, like being able to run and pass at the same time. Please do enjoy this unique barrel-aged ale today, but know that B-Bomb will age gracefully for at least another 5 years, as long as Kevin Pelton doesn't call it the best beer week in Seattle history. Don't be afraid to be abominable.
You know what this tastes of? You know what I got a note of?
What's that?
It tastes like Schmetzer time.
Oh, Schmetz time.
A toast to the Sounders. Fourth time in 5 years. In the 5 years since we've been recording this podcast again. Fourth time the Seattle Sounders are in MLS Cup final. And what a game it was.
Incredible. I mean, they did. We talk about this sports week that I'm going to break it to you right now before we get into it, was not the best Seattle sports week in history. But they did what both of the other teams couldn't do, and you had that inkling, because you're an idiot like myself, where you're like, wow, it's actually happening. Oh, maybe they're going to score too early, the thing that a stupid person would think. And I thought both of those things on Saturday, on Sunday, on Monday, and the Sounders actually did it. They actually came back, and I was like, huh, 4 minutes left of extra time. Let's not wait. Let's get this done right now. Let's not get to extra time. Let's do it right here in stoppage time. And that's what the Sounders did.
I mean, if we're just getting into it, which I assume we should, because of the excitement about this match, this was not the best performance by the Sounders in this run of repeated MLS Cup appearances, because that was last year in the Western Conference final against LAFC, beating a juggernaut team 3-1 on the road. It wasn't the most important of these games, because those would be the two MLS Cup finals at Toronto FC, or that they won at least, at Toronto FC in 16, and then home against Toronto FC last year for the first cup that they'd won in front of a full sellout crowd at then CenturyLink Field, now Lumen Field. But I think this is going to go down as the single most memorable match that the Sounders have ever played.
Wow.
I mean, social media lit up after this match in a way that it often does not during even playoff matches for the Sounders. And I think that's a combination of factors. Number one, to me, if you were comparing this to a Seattle sporty event in the past, it would be the 2014 NFC Championship game. Mm-hmm. Where, same thing, a team that's the defending champs, playing at home, seems like everything's set up perfectly, and then everything goes disastrously for like three quarters of the game, and then all of a sudden Mike McCarthy starts to run out the clock, and the Seahawks, and in this case the Sounders, come back. And that is such a thrilling moment. That's why we were suckered in on Saturday and Sunday. Maybe not as much on Sunday as Saturday, but like a comeback, something seemingly gone and then found again, the prodigal victory. It's the most, one of the most fun things in sports.
There's a term for this that you're dancing around, right? We saw the darkness.
Oh, we saw a lot of darkness.
And that's what really matters when you're paying attention to sport. This is why deep down in the back of your mind, you're like, it'd be kind of fun if they got down, right? Like you don't actually want to say it. I know that you want to get into the psychology of fandom later. But like the,
I don't know if we're going to be a full on into that. I'm just saying I could go there if I wanted to.
Anytime. This is why you pay attention to sport. Winning games is not actually that much fun. Seeing the darkness and coming back, the opposite of losing is so much more fun than winning. I was like, when this match started, I paid almost no attention the first 40 minutes or so, right? Even when the Sounders were down a goal. It was like I was doing other stuff. I was cooking dinner. I was doing whatever, right? I was going around.
Quarantine.
When Minnesota scored the second goal, that's when I was like, oh no. Like, things are real here. I can't take this for granted anymore, right? This is Wayne Gallman going off for that long run. You're like, oh, shit just got real. And that's what you need in sport to be like, it is time to lock in. And that's what happened to the Sounders. The second goal happened. And I think both, maybe the Sounders as a team, were even, despite the fact that this was the Western Conference Championship, maybe even taking this match for granted a little bit. And as fans, it was like, oh shit, we're not going to win this easily.
I mean, I don't know that I think they were taking it for granted. But the other thing that happened, the other reason that this was such a memorable game, you talk about this all the time. In a situation like this, in a knockout round game in soccer, when a team is down by multiple goals, that is when you are getting soccer to the maximum. And that's what we saw from the Sounders, just peppering shots over and over again down the stretch of this game. And that's so much fun.
Yes.
I mean, you know, soccer is obviously a very tense game in a different way than football, but there's very few situations where I can recall like being compelled to stand because of the excitement of a soccer match in the moment. And that definitely happened at least leading up to the second goal, and certainly between the second and third goals.
The match that I think you're forgetting though is the one that they lost to Portland a couple of years ago to knock them out of the playoffs.
Yeah, where, I mean that was memorable, but it's not,
but it was so back and forth. I mean, it had the same kind of energy as this match. It didn't have the same kind of onslaught, but that was like goal going back and forth. It was fun to watch as a sporting event unto itself.
The other thought I had during this match, when I was seeing the darkness, or maybe even before seeing the darkness, actually, was like, this season started with a knockout match at CenturyLink, what was then CenturyLink Field, now Lumen Field. It's been many different names over the course of the season, which has taken such a long time, as it always does in MLS, but even longer this year. And that ended in penalty kicks and like a shocking loss where the Sounders, it seemed like we're going to cruise in that one against, I've forgotten the club, in CONCACAF Champions League, Marathon.
Sure.
That we were both at. And then all of a sudden they give up an equalizing goal late in that one against the run of play. And there's no extra time, goes directly to PKs, and they lose on PKs. And it's like, oh, that was depressing, before we realized, hey, we're not going to get to go to another live sporting event for 9 months and counting. And that's actually what should have been depressing.
I went to that match just so uptight the entire time.
I didn't have a concern.
Real, that is so wild. It was the most uncomfortable I've been in public, maybe ever.
Should we go through the rundown of this match for anyone who missed out on the specific details?
Oh, they're still racing out at the trestles. Let's hear it.
By the way, it sounds like we're playing Minnesota United. I don't think we mentioned that at any point during this conversation.
I mentioned it. I mentioned Minnesota.
Okay, good. Emmanuel Reynoso, their designated player, opens the scoring in the 29th minute with a gorgeous left-footed free kick from just outside the top of the 18. The Sounders really struggled with their...
Seemed like Fry hesitated for a second.
I don't know if there was anything he was getting. I mean, that was so...
I mean, it was a perfect ball.
Sounders struggled with their final touch in the box in the first half, but they did appear to have the equalizer in the 53rd minute when Raul Ruiz Diaz beat keeper Dane St. Clair 1v1 before VAR overturned the goal for a foul on Ruiz Diaz beating his defender.
Then I didn't even know you could do that.
Yes, you can.
I mean, honestly, I thought VAR was just about reviewing offsides or if something was in the box or something like that. But they actually can go back. They can look at anything. Is that true? All plays are reviewable?
I don't know the exact specifics, but certainly all goals are going to be reviewable, yes.
Okay.
Then a near miss for the Sounders in the 65th minute when Jordan Morris hit the post.
But this isn't all goals are going to be reviewable. Like, this isn't like in the NFL you can review it. Oh, they should have actually called an OPI, right? That's not reviewable. This is, they can go review anything in the lead up to the goal.
Yeah. I mean, anything that's specifically related to it, at least. The Loons made the Sounders pay almost immediately, getting their second goal from a Bakai Debassi header off a cross from Reynoso in the 66th minute. Sounders then got on the board in the 75th minute with a Will Ruin putback of a Raul Ruiz Diaz blocked shot 2 minutes after coming on as a substitute, something Brian Schmetzer credited in the postgame interview is really changing the tide of the game. And I think certainly.
I mean, you saw the goal that Ruiz Diaz scored in the 90th minute. He immediately went to Will Bruin and gave him a hug. Like, there was definitely a connection there. And I think it's undeniable just the energy that Will Bruin brought to the match when he came in.
The energy and just his presence in the box, as Schmetzer mentioned, because, you know, that was something, there was a lot of situations where there wasn't somebody directly in front of goal, or, you know, you're trying to get a little too cute with the extra pass, something that worked well for them against LAFC, but maybe they've tried a little bit too much to do the last two matches. But Bruin is going to be a little more direct, and that's what it took in this match. So still the Sounders needed another goal. They had 15 minutes to get it, plus stoppage time. And for pretty much the entire 15 minutes, they were unable to come through. But then Ruiz Diaz comes free on the far side of the box in the 90th minute and puts through the equalizing goal for, you know, just delirium.
It was perfect. The way that led up to the goal, and you see Ruiz Diaz with the ball, and you're like, you're doing the math in your head instantaneously, and it's like, he's going to score this. there are times when you're watching in soccer and you're like, I don't think that's going in. And you saw that, and you saw the reaction of the defenders. And it was like, this is, if you were there on the field and could look at it, you're like, this is actually wide open for Ruiz Diaz. It's harder to tell from the TV camera angle, but it was like, this was an as easy of a goal by the time it hit Raul Ruiz Diaz's feet for him to score.
And at that point, the other thing that I didn't mention in this is like the confidence that the Sounders were going to find a way was so high. Like you didn't know if they were that they were actually going to be able to do it in stoppage time, but you know they were creating so many opportunities, and they just had so much talent basically that at some point it felt like they were going to find their way through. But the actual winning goal from an unlikely source. Gustav Svensson coming off the bench in his first appearance of the playoffs after what he confirmed after the match was a bout with COVID-19. He was the Sounders player who tested positive on the eve of the playoffs after being with his national team, the Sweden national team. Headed home, the winner in the 94th minute, his first goal for the Sounders of 2020.
Big one.
They don't get much bigger than that.
Whew. And, you know, I don't think you can overstate how crucial it was, because if you get into extra time, it's a little bit different. You know, I think you could say that the Sounders possibly would have scored in that 30-minute period, but it's not a given. You go back way less. This was their period to play soccer. They had one window to play soccer, and they had the entire run of play on their side. They had all of the, I don't want to call it momentum because that's not what it is, but there are these periods in soccer where one team is just going to dominate possession. And the Sounders were in one of those periods, and it was like they were going to be there until the match was over. They might have maintained that during extra time, but who knows? And obviously, if you get to penalty kicks, it's a crapshoot, right? It doesn't really matter where you are. We saw them, like you mentioned, lose on penalty kicks to begin this season. It was crucial to get this goal in before regulation ended.
Well, the other aspect of it is, I mean, I think to your point, they would have been favored, I assume, in extra time just because they have the home field and are the better team. But they had expended a lot of energy in this comeback. There's a reason teams don't play soccer from that standpoint all the time, and that's because it's really hard to do, man. So,
8-year-olds out there doing it all the time. They never play defense.
I mean, 8-year-olds are a different story. The other aspect of it is
play soccer.
The other aspect of it is you saved 30 minutes of wear and tear with the final 6 days away, which is not an inconsiderable thing.
Huge.
By the way, it was Olympia, CD Olympia from Honduras that they lost to on the PK shootout back in February. So Saturday. In MLS Cup 2020, they'll travel to face Toronto. Wait, nope, Columbus.
I made this joke last week and you didn't even get it.
I missed it at that point, yes. At Mayfair Stadium at 5 p.m. Pacific on Saturday on Fox. Should we talk about Columbus?
Briefly, yes.
5:38.
Can I just say, the only thing that sucks about MLS playoffs is like you're looking around and you're like, this is Minnesota United. I've never heard of a player on Minnesota United. And
you've never heard of Osvaldo Alonso?
Well, okay, yes, I've heard of Ozzy Alonso. But it's not like, you know, if you're in different sports, right? You're in the NBA Finals. You're like, this is not actually true of this year's NBA Finals. But let's say it's from the Heat perspective. But you're like, that's LeBron James over there, right? Like, it feels like there's like dragons that need to be slayed along the way. And for the Sounders, they had that last year, like you mentioned, with LAFC. But it is like this, because of the circumstances, it was an exciting match. But if it would have been just a Saturday in August playing against Minnesota United, it just would have been a match. I mean, and I think that's the only part of it where it's just like, it sucks that there aren't bigger stars in MLS where you can just be like, wow, we beat so-and-so. It's not like the Champions League where, or like that the teams don't mean anything, right? You didn't beat Arsenal. You didn't beat Liverpool. You didn't beat Juventus. You didn't beat Real Madrid. You're like, yeah, no, we beat Minnesota United, who've been a team for 3 fucking years.
I mean, look, that was the Sounders once upon a time. What makes it different, I feel like, than the other major American sports is that MLS isn't really a national sport in the same way. It's a much more regional sport in that we follow the Sounders, but I don't watch very many MLS games that don't involve them. So, you know, someone like Ray Nosa, I'm not going to see their brilliance on a regular basis, even if they are a great player.
Even in baseball, though, where like baseball is a regional sport, but you're still like,
the teams have a different thing there. Yes.
Yes. And there are like, even in the World Series, I'm like, okay, I don't know these players that well, but you're like, I've heard of some of these people.
You know, Clayton Kershaw.
Yeah. But I think just it's also new, just the history and the weight of it, you know. But the Sounders, that is the cool thing on the opposite side of that spectrum, is the Sounders are those teams now. Like, you talk about them going to the MLS Cup 4 out of the last 5 years. They're the dragon that needs to be slayed if you're Minnesota United. They're the team who all of a sudden just happened to be in the right circumstances. They're the team that you're up 2 goals against at the 75th minute and they come back and win. So it's kind of incredible to be the world class of the MLS, to be the team that can't be beaten, right?
Yeah, I saw David Locke tweeted something about this match, and there was like an RSL fan who replied to that, like, yeah, the Sounders always come through.
That's what we want.
It's
right?
Like, wow, what a place to be.
We want Columbus Crew to be like, oh, fuck, we need to play the Sounders, you know?
Seriously. Like, I don't know how to handle that as a Seattle sports fan. That's not something we're used to. Although I have a take about this, and I'm going to deliver it. I'm saving it for the 2020 Sports Year in Review podcast.
Just think how a Husky football fan who was a fan in the 90s to this day still somehow. That's how you handle it.
Any minute now, we're going to resume dominance over Oregon. But that's...
overconfidence and expectation that the team will be an amazing team on the national level for the rest of your life.
And being upset at Jake Browning for not being good enough. We're going to talk about that later in the pod. For now, we're talking about the final.
Okay,
Columbus Soccer Crew. Power Index has the final as an even 50-50 matchup.
Hello.
A complete toss-up.
Let's play Sounders soccer.
Better SPI rating offset by the home field advantage for Columbus, which hosts the final thanks to 0.01 more points per match during the regular season.
Wow.
If the Sounders had not had their match at LA Galaxy canceled due to the Wildcat strike, as it turned out, and had won that match, which is no guarantee, obviously, they would have hosted the final.
Wow. Are there fans in Columbus or no?
There are 1,500 fans in attendance at this match.
1,500 strong.
Yeah. The Crew were the number 3 seed in the East, but have gotten to host every round thanks to upsets of the top 2 East seeds in the opening round. Had to sweat out their conference semifinal matchup with Nashville SC, which was scoreless through 90 minutes before the Crew scored twice in extra time. Then got the only goal in the 59th minute of the conference final versus number 8 seed New England, completing their second consecutive clean sheet. The Crew are coached by longtime Portland Timbers manager Caleb Porter, who was hired in 2019 after parting ways with the Timbers at the end of the 2017 season. This is the third MLS Cup final for Porter, whose Timbers won in 2015, beating Columbus, but lost in 2017 just before he left. The franchise won its only MLS Cup in 2008 under Ziggy Schmidt, who subsequently joined the Sounders as their inaugural coach immediately after that match.
Shouts to Ziggy.
Yeah, the late, great Ziggy Schmidt.
A legend.
And one of the inaugural MLS clubs nearly moved to Austin in 2018 before sale to a group led by Cleveland Browns owner Jimmy Haslam. Crew missed the playoffs last season, but have bounced back this year, led by forward Jossie Zardes, the longtime LA Galaxy USMNT fixture.
I've heard of him.
Exactly. Who scored 14 goals in the regular season, has 2 so far in the playoffs. Winger Pedro Santos had 8 goals and 8 assists, plus 2 more goals in the playoffs. And their big addition this season was number 10, Lucas Salarian, is a third designated player with the highest transfer fee in club history. That translated into 6 goals and 8 assists.
Where is he from?
Argentina. Mm-hmm. Bizarrely, despite Columbus being in the East, this is actually the first playoff opponent since LAFC the Sounders have played in 2020. Way back in March, 9 months ago today, these teams drew 1-1 in the most recent Seattle sporting event with fans in attendance.
Oh, wow. That was that game that should have never been played.
It
was against
game.
Columbus Crew. I remember watching that and just being like, I mean, if earlier that week, I felt like really uptight being at a soccer match.
The previous week, before we knew about any cases in the Seattle, or I mean, we knew about the one case, the index case in Snohomish County, but that was a month before.
Watching that match, I mean, it was definitely not packed at then CenturyLink Field. There were a lot of people who chose to sit that one out. But watching that match, it's like you feel like you're at the very beginning of a zombie apocalypse. And everybody else is still sort of going out, and you're like, I wouldn't do that if I were you.
And yet it's just kind of unthinkable that that was allowed to happen. But who would have known at the time that 9 months later that things were going to be worse? Hey! Goals in that one from Zardes and Rui Diaz.
We're going to have a pretty wild year in review. I was thinking about that.
That's a lot.
We're gonna have to do both a Seattle sports year in review with like a little bit of national year in review, just because what a strange year it's been.
It has. Yeah, a lot's happened. Chances of victory?
I guess 50%.
I'm going 55%. I'm confident here.
Ballsy.
Sound is riding this wave.
I mean, if we're being honest, it is a 50% chance of victory. Sounders have been there. They've done this, right? Like, this is not – nobody's overwhelmed by the moment. They don't have to play the Sounders, who've been there for the last 5 years. This is a Sounders team who – the pressure of the MLS Cup Finals, nothing to them. You know, they've had this core together, played huge matches. They can get down to nothing and still come back and win. So I think that you're right that it's actually a better than 50% chance of victory. I don't know how much traveling to Columbus matters. I feel like it's probably very little. I also, what stadium do they play in? They have a specific soccer stadium.
They do. Mayfair
Stadium. Couldn't be anybody else, right? It's not like they play in the Horseshoe.
They did originally. When they came in the league in 96, they did. They were
probably
one of the
very bad idea to play in like the biggest stadium in the country.
I think it was very empty, yes. I think that's part of the move towards soccer-specific. But they also have a new soccer-specific stadium under construction that will open next year. This will be the last match at Mayfair Stadium.
So I guess it's probably a relatively small stadium, right?
I think it's like 20,000 or so, yeah.
Okay. Well, I guess my feeling is that having few fans is actually worse than having no fans.
How many matches have the Sounders played in front of fans since play stopped? I think Real Salt Lake was the only team they played who allowed fans, if I recall correctly.
I assume there'll be Sounders fans there too.
Well, the tickets are all going to season ticket holders, so it has to be someone selling them on the resale market, the secondary market. So it's such a weird, it's all bad.
Saturday night. Let's go.
It's going to be a big day Saturday.
Oh, some are saying.
No, I didn't say a good day. I said a big day. One other piece of Sounders news before we move on. Toronto's Alejandro Pozuelo was named MLS MVP, with Nico Ladero finishing third and Jordan Morris fifth in the voting behind Pozuelo and Golden Boot winner Diego Rossi. So there you go.
They do an MVP in MLS?
Yeah.
What would you call this in another league in the EPL, say?
I don't know. In the World Cup, it's the... Yeah.
Well, there's the Ballon d'Or, right? Which is basically like the Worldwide Player of the Year.
Yes, but that is FIFA specific rather than like a league, so... It's a little different.
Okay. I just didn't even know that there was an MLS MVP.
There is an MLS MVP. One thing I learned from this news is that the vote is broken up among several different groups. So there's fans, like the team staff vote, and then media.
All right. So the rest of our toasts.
Yeah, getting back to our toasts.
Now that we've toasted the Sounders.
We have officially toasted the Sounders. Two, Brianna Stewart, Storm Star, among five athletes featured as Sports Illustrated awarded its Sports Person of the Year honor this in 2022, quote, the activist athlete. The others are fellow MVPs and champions LeBron James and Patrick Mahomes, tennis star Naomi Osaka, and Chiefs offensive lineman Laurent Duvernay-Tardif, who is sitting out this season to work as a doctor amidst the pandemic. Definitely some criticism of this choice in terms of featuring a WNBA player as part of their efforts on behalf of the Black community, who's not herself Black. I mean, I see this both ways in terms of it's obviously Stewart's role as an ally is important to show that this is not just an issue that Black people care about, that, you know, white people are involved in this as well. But, you know, not having taken the opportunity to highlight some of the Black players in the WNBA who are really heavily involved in this as well. Former Storm player Renee Montgomery, Natasha Cloud, etc. Understand the criticism there.
I just would have expected so much more from Sports Illustrated.
Exactly.
A magazine that had its peak level of popularity 70 years ago.
And lastly, this week, we are pouring
one despite out. The fact that 1980 was 20 years ago.
Oh, no. We're very old. Pour one out for Steven Hauschka, who announced his retirement at age 35. Hauschka played 13 seasons in the NFL, 6 with the Seahawks, and his second in franchise history in points scored behind longtime kicker Norm Johnson.
Haushmani.
Turns out kickers score a lot of points.
I'm a little bit surprised by that. I mean, he was the kicker during, you know, the best time period in Seahawks history, and he was the kicker for a fairly long time period. But I guess I can't really think of anybody else. You know, the Seahawks have gone kind of from, they've had sort of long-term kickers for a while there. Josh Brown was the only one that comes to mind.
He was not the kicker as long as you think he was. If you go by points per game, Hauschka, I believe, is first all time.
How do they award points? Like, if you're a quarterback, does it have to be a rushing touchdown for you to get the
you
points?
You have to
passing
score the
touchdowns?
Touchdown.
Okay.
In the official definition of points.
Who is the skill player with the most points scored? I have a guess at who this is, but
yeah, why don't you just guess who it is?
I'm guessing it's Sean Alexander.
It is Sean Alexander, who has 112 career touchdowns, number 2 among skill position players. Steve Largent with 101, number 3 Marshawn Lynch with 66, plus the only one of those with a 2-point conversion, and Kurt Warner with 62, the other Seahawks position.
None of those other players got a 2-point conversion?
Nope.
Well, I'm shocked Sean Alexander never got a 2-point conversion.
It is kind of surprising, yes.
I feel like maybe he didn't demand the ball in those plays.
Oh my God, do you know who the Seahawks all-time leader is in 2-point conversions? There's only one Seahawk who's ever scored more than 2 2-point conversions.
Is it Luke Wilson?
No.
Who is it?
It is 90s running back Lamar Smith.
Wow.
The ones with 2 are Chris Warren, and Jeremy Stevens, and Ben Obomanu.
Ben Obomanu?
That is an amazing trivia question. If we ever bring back Pelton Guest Trivia, I'm calling that one back. So, you know, you're going to get the free one there if you remember this section of the pod.
You said Lamar Smith was
4. It's twice as many as anyone else in Seahawks history.
Could we do a virtual trivia?
Why not?
I don't know if I've seen any of those.
It's probably easier to cheat that way.
I mean, people could pull out their phones at the trivia night. Nobody's really stopping them. We're kind of operating under the honor system here.
Third Pelton brother, Nate Taggart, didn't need to. All right, with the toasts in the books, we are skipping food this week. We just have too much to talk about. Next week, we are going to get into a review of Chengdu Taste, which we did finally get to last week. We're going to go in reverse order of our usual rundown this week. And start off by talking about the Seahawks, because it turns out we got a lot of problems with you people.
It's an all-emergency podcast. You like that? Every single segment's an emergency podcast unto itself.
So the Seahawks, as you alluded to earlier, lost 17-12 at home to the New York Giants, who were starting their backup quarterback, Colt McCoy. This is a thing that happened. And I've got some grievances.
Oh, yes. Everybody, Festivus came early this year. Do you want to see the darkness on the edge of town? No. The darkness is right here on the Pelton cast. We saw the darkness and we succumbed to the darkness this Sunday. Tell us your grievances.
On Twitter for sure succumbed to the darkness.
The tradition of Festivus begins with the airing of grievances. I got a lot of problems with you people. Now you're going to hear about it.
There's one question on the minds of everyone in Seattle today, and it's not who will replace Jenny Durkin as mayor in 2021. Instead, everyone wants to know, what's wrong with the Seahawks offense? In the wake of Sunday's loss to the Giants, people want answers. Whose fault is it? Is the Seahawks offense broken? Is this all because the Seahawks let Russ cook? And to those people, I have one thing to say. Get a fucking grip! I was amazed to see a headline on The Ringer describing Sunday as the Seahawks offense, quote, reaching new levels of offensive ineptitude. Do you want to know how many times in the Russell Wilson era, which is, of course, the most successful era in Seahawks history by leaps and bounds, they've averaged fewer yards per play than the 4.7 they did against the Giants on Sunday? 24! Per StatHead.com. During the 2013 season, the Seahawks won at St. Louis with 3.4 yards per play and then lost to Arizona at home in week 16 with 3.8 yards per play. 6 weeks later, that broken offense won the fucking Super Bowl 43-8. Shitty performances happen. The Chiefs barely beat the Broncos on Sunday. The Vikings needed overtime to beat the 1-10 Jaguars. And the Raiders, needing a win to stay in the playoff race, nearly lost to the Jets. More on that later. Now, obviously, there's a difference between a bad performance and a win and a home loss to a below 500 team starting its backup quarterback. Sunday may end up costing the Seahawks the NFC West and certainly takes them out of the race for the lone bye in the conference. It matters. But just because something matters doesn't mean it tells us what's going to happen in the future. Even more than a performance like this from the Seahawks every December, I am so exhausted by the endless dialogue. We cannot have every Seahawks game double as a referendum on whether letting one of the league's best quarterbacks actually pass is a good idea. Those 24 shittier offensive performances I mentioned, they came during different times when the Seahawks passed more or passed less. They came with different running backs, different offensive coordinators, and different receivers, and different offensive lines. Shitty games happen. And at some point, we have to be okay with that, no matter how frustrating it might be.
That stat is wild. When you were like, do you know how many games they've averaged fewer yards per carry? I thought you were going to say it was like two or whatever. And you went the exact opposite direction. 24 is like, it is significant statistically.
That's three per season almost.
In 2017,
they had like five of these games.
Well, we don't really need to talk about 2017.
We don't. And I grant that the offensive environment in 2020 is much friendlier than it was in some
just,
of those
just
years.
Being like, well, it was better than 2017 doesn't actually mean it was good. But
I'm not saying it was good. Again, it was a shitty performance. But we don't need to do a fucking inquest about whose fault is this? Who should get fired? Like, bad games happen.
They usually
happen in the rain and against
literally
the blitz, which
all
is
that matters is that they lost. That's the only reason. Of those 24 games, do you know what was the win percentage in those games? Did you look?
They did win a shocking number of them for averaging fewer than 4.0. Whatever
I mean,
the number was yards per
that,
play.
That Rams game that you're talking about in 2014 was the Monday night game against, remind me of the quarterback?
Kellen Clemens. Every year we go over that it was Kellen Clemens. Year you forget that it was Kellen Clemens.
Kellen Clemens is a worse quarterback than Colt McCoy is. Colt McCoy is competent. Like, they
13-11 in those games, for the record.
They were better than 500 in games that they had a worse yards per play than they had on Sunday.
I mean, a lot of what happened is bad luck.
a lot of this year they had a very good defense too. But like I don't think you can even blame the defense for this loss.
No. The defense played well. But sometimes a ball is going to go through Chris Carson's hands into his helmet and bounce to a Giants defender in position to just set them up for a field goal. Like, I don't know what to tell you about that. Like, we don't need a deep analysis of that play.
I kept coming back to, in my head, that Kellen Clemens game, though. Whereas, like, they can't fucking do anything. Like, the Seahawks just have games like this. But I think if we were to get down to it granularly, every team has games like this. There's no, like, the Saints, who had roughly the same roster, granted their defense is quite a bit worse, had, like, a bunch of 7-9 seasons for a period of time. Like, there's no quarterback who is immune to having bad games ever. And the point that I was going to make, it's interesting that you brought it up, is similar to, I want to get into this deeper later. Actually, I'm not going to say that right now. Let's do it. Similar to when the Giants kicked a field goal in the fourth quarter on a 4th-and-1 play, Pete Carroll called a timeout beforehand, which was a terrible decision, of course. And especially,
they were not sure whether they had 12 men on the field, which would have given the Giants a first down.
Okay. That makes
he said that post game, yes.
That makes more sense why they blew that timeout.
It wasn't like, I don't know.
Did they have 12 men on the field, or were they just not sure either way?
No one has weighed in. Ben watched the tape on this one. Third Baldwin brother, Ben Baldwin. He did not mention whether they in fact had 12 players.
Even if they thought, if somebody said that we have 12 men on the field and it would have been a first down, it's probably worth taking the timeout. But
yes, even though it was certainly a timeout you missed and knew you were going to need at that situation.
When the Giants lined up to kick that field goal, Pete Carroll should have gotten down on his knees and prayed to God that they made that choice instead of going for it. Because that decision was a horrible decision. Wait, I forgot where I was going at this point.
Was it about the fact that the Seahawks didn't go for some fourth downs in this game?
No, it was a totally different point. Wow. Here's what it was. The Seahawks should be so thankful that they have gotten this game out of the way early. It's December. We act like this never fucking happens. And every year a game like this happens, usually to the Arizona Cardinals, sometimes on the road to the 49ers, sometimes to both with a good team. Like, this is not a unique situation. I don't understand why this one particular game has meant that everybody had to rein in with the takes, but maybe they do this every time this happens. Like,
to an extent, yes. I mean, the last time it happened was Arizona in Week 16 last year.
They just distracted us. They signed Marshawn Lynch, and we all forgot about it.
But we were set to record an extremely angry emergency pod about it after I flew back from Las Vegas, which is a thing you could do back in 2019.
You went on an airplane?
I did.
Wow.
I did. You know, before that, I was in restaurants and at a football game, all sorts of things that you can't do now.
I don't like the sound of it. Similar to how Pete Carroll should have gotten down on his knees and prayed when the Giants trotted out Graham Gano for a long field goal, they should do the same in this situation that they got this game out of the way early, because the Seahawks, at their core, are reactionary. They are not a proactive team. They are a reactive team. This is what Pete Carroll does. He waits for something to go wrong, and then he responds to it. And I think that
you're always solving the most recent problem,
which is a long term, if we want to look at it, probably not a great process, but
definitely it is a great process.
It is good for them to get this out of the way early, because there were issues with this offense that had been bubbling for 4 or 5 weeks that it feels like playing the Giants and getting lucky where they were blitzing and not playing too high safety, or playing the Eagles, and they're not playing too high safeties. Like, they didn't deal with issues that are going to be a factor long-term for this particular 2020/hopefully 2021 Seahawks team. Hopefully they could get those issues over with now in week 13 instead of week 16 or week 17 or the playoffs. Like, this is I don't mean to rationalize, because a lot of bad happened in this game, but it was a good thing to lose to the Giants. Also, as we saw today with the Steelers losing the Washington football team, this was bound to start coming. Like, I think the Giants...
I didn't even put that in my list.
The Giants and Washington... I figured you wrote that before that game. The Giants and
I
Washington...
Did it after. I don't know why I didn't even include it.
Were both teams that have probably, through the second half of the season, played better than their record. I mean, The Giants are not as bad of a team as their record. Like, there was a story about how this was one of the worst losses of the Pete Carroll era, and I do not buy that.
It's It's not, but the one thing about the Giants being better than their record is that was not with Colt McCoy at quarterback, and Colt McCoy did nothing in this game.
The player who's playing well, though, has been Wayne Gallman, though, and Wayne Gallman did do something. But also, you have to come back and just look at these, like, and, you know, I saw the thread of Russell Wilson, like, missing receivers. I think even in a good game, you could go through a thread of Russell Wilson missing receivers. Like,
of course.
The nature of looking at this is there's going to be open receivers that quarterbacks aren't going to hit on certain plays. Literally no quarterback is going to hit every single open receiver. And I don't think that Russell Wilson is, like, broken or whatever. I don't even think he's necessarily being cautious in the pocket. Did he play a bad game? Yes. Was it that bad of a game? I'm not convinced. He dropped.
He's just had a lot worse games, as it turns out.
He dropped a snap. He had a ball that bounced off Chris Carson's head. To me, the worst play that he threw, the worst ball they threw all game, nobody's even talking about, and that was the guaranteed game-ending interception that he threw on the last drive. And it was
that,
like,
that was dropped.
And that, like, you saw that pass go up, and we've seen this happen a lot of Russell Wilson on final drives throwing interceptions. It's been a few years since we've seen it, but, like, that play has happened before where the defender went up and made the play. And it was like, that was a terrible throw that Russ made. You know, he missed the hole completely. And you rarely see Russ miss a hole like that. But also, he wasn't given the chance to do the things that he does well. Like, Russell Wilson, the Giants specifically defended against letting Russell Wilson throw deep balls and beat them over the top. I think Russell Wilson is good at everything, but if they're going to do that, you have to beat them another way. And I'm not convinced that the Seahawks were able to beat them in another way. And I think this is why you come back to shoddy in the game planning. Like, I don't know. I didn't see specifically what Carson's success rate was on carries, but I have to imagine it was fairly good in this game. And I look at other offenses and I see the proverbial taking what the defense is willing to give you. Right? You always would prefer to pass the ball, but
oh my, Carson's success rate on rushes was 29%.
Really? So it was really bad.
That is shocking. I have to go look at those individual plays to understand that better.
All right, let's talk to the fucking people who are talking about giving Carson the ball more.
I mean, you did say earlier when we talked about this game that you felt like the Seahawks should have run more.
I think they should have, but that was before I heard that he had a 29% success rate. I think people are looking at a few carries of 10 yards and saying this was a great running game. It was a small sample size, if anything. Yards per carry is a deceiving stat, though. Like, I wish that they would put in the fucking box score success rate, because yard per carry doesn't actually tell the story of the game. Right. Not that that's ever going to happen. But there are certain situations where if you need to run, you run. And if you need to throw short, you throw short. Right? You have to be able to counteract this. You can't telegraph every single fucking play. We've talked about this over and over and over again. The one advantage that the offense has against the defense is that the defense doesn't know what the offense is doing. And it feels like the Seahawks team the last few weeks, the defense has known what they're doing. Like, they run a screen, the defense knows. If they're trying to leak Chris Carson out, the defense knows. I don't think that's fundamentally a bad play to run on fourth down, but it just felt like they didn't fool anybody. And I don't understand how a team like this can be so unable to fool defenses with what they're doing and what they're setting up. And that, to me, leads me to believe that they're being predictable with the offense.
Right. I agree with that. I'm still looking up these Russell Wilson, these Chris Carson plays. You got anything else here?
I really went on a very long monologue. I can come up with more, though. The other piece that we're not talking about is receivers drop balls. Like, DK Metcalf drops a monster pass over the middle. Tyler Lockett on this, we might be talking about a Seahawks victory if Tyler Lockett doesn't drop that pass on 2nd and 10 on the final drive.
There's like so many little things that when you talk about the difference between winning the game and losing the game. The not being able to recover the blocked punt in the end zone and only getting 2 points out of that instead of 7.
Absolutely. That's why look, it's football. There aren't that many games. You have to respond to every game. I mean, you don't have to do this, but like, I'm just, the people who are out there that saying things like, I woke up embarrassed about the Seahawks team. Just like, cool the fuck off, dude. You know, like, everybody please chill the fuck out. First off, this is a football game and we're in the middle of a pandemic, right? Like, how many people in the United States got diagnosed with COVID yesterday?
The most exciting news about the Seahawks in the past week is that when they put Brian Monet on the COVID-19 list, it was not because of a positive test. It was because of a close contact.
Wow. Look at that.
Still huge. No positive tests.
But we're playing football in the middle of a pandemic. We should just, again, as an atheist, I've referenced getting on your knees and praying to God many times, but we should be getting on our fucking knees and praying to God that we have something to pay attention to, because this NFL season couldn't have happened at all. Right.
You know, like, I think, by the way, the box score was wrong. Chris Carson had a much better success rate than 29%. That was wrong.
Okay. I've got takes to fill every different section. whatever way it went, I will respond to that.
It looks like 9 of his 13 carries were successful.
Okay, because I was ready.
NFL Fast Star.
I was ready to say that we should have been running the ball more, but then you told me a 29% success rate, so I felt like I had to go the opposite direction. Anyway, we're still...
some great motivated reasoning here.
We're playing football in the middle of a pandemic. You can't be that upset about it.
Oh, yeah. I don't know how I misread that. It does say 69% on the box score.
It says...
You know what? Maybe it hadn't updated from the Dallas game yet.
How to cook default. Four humans. You just had to blow off the dust a little bit. But the point is, like, it's embarrassing to be so upset about this. When, again, I've said this every single recap pod that we've done.
And look, we all felt that in the moment.
We are lucky to be watching Russell Wilson play football. And the only thing that I care about is that we are out here having this opportunity to watch Russell Wilson play football. And I don't give a fuck if he misses one receiver open or whatever, right? Like, we're still watching the greatest quarterback we will watch in our entire lives play football right now. If you want to be upset about that, that's on you, because the quarterback waiting after him might not be fucking Russell Wilson.
Oh, will not. Like,
this, and this also is a relationship that is more important to us and the franchise than Pete Carroll is, than any of the goddamn running backs are, than DK Metcalf is, any of them. This is a person who, if all goes well, will be in our lives for another 10 years as the Seahawks quarterback.
I mean, the only time in NFL history, really, that a team has replaced a quarterback as good as Russell Wilson with an equally good quarterback.
There have been a few, but...
I mean, it's Favre to Rodgers, right?
Well, Montana to Steve Young.
Yeah, I guess that's a good one.
Jameis to Brady.
I mean, Manning to Luck is...
There have been actually, I think, quite a few scenarios.
But Russell Wilson is so far ahead of every other quarterback in Seahawks history, with all due respect to the great Matt Hasselbeck, who I was hoping was going to weigh in after I pointed out had the longest intentional grounding in the past 20 years in the NFL.
The longest intentional grounding?
Yeah, because I was looking up whether Carson Wentz's that wasn't called on Monday night would have been the longest. And Matt Hass...
Okay,
back
if
in
we're
2000...
talking here, ball falls right in front of the ref. 2 yards. 2 yards in front of the ref.
But then also, for Russ to get called for that intentional grounding on the play where DK just ran the wrong direction.
Oh, no, that was such bullshit. Like...
That's why I don't think intentional grounding should be a thing. That's one of my strongest takes, is I don't think that intentional grounding should exist as a rule.
Terrible take. Awful take.
Why are you,
hate it.
Why are you trying to tell intentionality?
Maybe if the rule was the ball just has to reach the line of scrimmage. But if you're about to get sacked and you just throw it in the ground in front of you, come on.
No, I think reaching the line of scrimmage is a fair, because that's in theory, it's an absolute standard. It's not requiring the referee to judge intent.
I don't quite get why being out of the pocket is part of it. Like, what's the difference? Who cares? Who cares if you're out of the pocket?
I mean, but, you know, people will say that a rule is arbitrary. Literally all the rules are arbitrary.
Oh, every rule is arbitrary. The whole fucking sport where
the
is
end
arbitrary.
Zone is arbitrary. You know, you go to the CFL, the end zone's in a different spot, man.
God, we just need rouges is what I've been trying to say. That's the entire take this whole time. Anyway, so Chris, we probably should have run the ball more. Like, if Chris Carson was successful on 9 of 12 carries, we probably should have run the ball more. And I think that they come to this game, and I think that one of the issues that the Seahawks have is I think there is a deep lack of feel for offense. And this is – honestly, it seems like it's the case
– Skybox Shoddy.
But it's not that Skybox Shoddy is a bad coordinator. I think that the Seahawks as a team have a lack of feel. It's a feel for offense. Like when you watch certain coaches, you could be like, that coach just knows what to do, when to do it. And that's all about you can just, it's a feel for the game. It's they're expecting this, I'm going to do this. They're expecting this, I'm going to do this. Like, and those coaches, do you know what their names are? Head coach. That's their name. Their name is not offensive coordinator. Like those coaches, if you're a coach who has that level of ability, their name is... I think Brian Dable's pretty good, but he was a head coach, right?
I think he was for a minute. He's going to be a head coach next year. I like his odds.
But the Kyle Shanahans, the Sean McVays, the Matt LaFleurs, those are coaches, the Eric Bieniemy next year. Like, those are coaches who are promoted immediately. Those aren't coaches that you get when they're fired from working at the University of Georgia, when they were with the Jets for a couple of years. Like, this is not the expectation that we would even find an offensive coordinator that is that good is honestly pretty ridiculous. Like, and I think we'll talk about this when we talk about UW football too. There are probably, have we had this conversation on podcast or has it just been offline?
I think just offline.
I think there are maybe 5 to 10 good offensive coordinators or offensive minds in the entire world when it comes to football who have the capability of understanding when to do things, when to run certain plays in certain situations, who also are able to build an offense from the ground up. It just doesn't exist that much. And also those people, they age out of it very quickly. Like it is a unique thing. There's almost nobody who is capable of building an offense for their entire life, you know, and it's totally situational. There's just so much that goes into it. It's about situation and talent and feel, and it's like, I think that the Seahawks team, the biggest issue that they have is they have a very hard time, and I think Shoddy has a very hard time, of looking at what the defense is giving them and taking advantage of that. And it's true on the opposite side of the ball, too. When you looked at the Bills' game plan, you say, wow, they had a great game plan to stop the run, but the Bills chose not to run, so we just fucking pissed our pants. Like, you have to be able to adjust. And I don't think that the Seahawks are very good at adjusting to what they're getting in games. And I think that that's something that has been the case for a long time. And I think it's a long-term Pete Carroll issue. You know, he won at USC because he had the best fucking players on earth. And it's not that hard to win when you have the best players on earth.
But somehow when Pete Carroll had the best players on earth, he coached more optimally and was big balls Pete and was going for fourth downs on a regular basis. And now
what it took to be big balls Pete is
punting from the 37.
Not that hard. Also, that's the other thing. It's like we all want to fucking blame Russell Wilson for the – I feel like I'm just really on a roll here. This B-bomb's got me going. If you want to blame Russell Wilson for this loss, you can't look past the fact that he wasn't put in the best possible situations. And all of the teams that we respect, right? All the offenses that we're excited about, they go for that fourth down, right?
Sean McVay and Kyle Shanahan.
But do you punt? That's the thing, is that it was the worst of the three options available to them at that time.
Yeah, the fact that Pete Carroll was like, after the game, was like, well, it was too long to kick a field goal, so therefore we were excited to punt. It's like, you know, there's a third option here. Those aren't the only two choices.
I don't even think it was too long to kick a field goal, though.
Well, I mean, again, it's a conditions-based situation. I'm not going to disagree with Pete Carroll on that part of it.
It was a beautiful day.
But if you look at if you look at the NFC Championship game in 2013/14 against the 49ers, it was too long a kick for Steven Hauschka to kick at the end of the third quarter. So what did they do? They came out and went for it, and Jermaine Kearse scored the winning touchdown in that game on fourth down.
Not the end of the third quarter, but...
It was into the fourth. Have we discussed this before?
It was... Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, this is the
not
Niners
the Green
game.
Bay Championship game.
Yeah, yes, that's
obviously
the thing.
That was an off. It's like, I get that.
He's out there talking about how the offense didn't get enough done. You didn't give him a fucking chance to get enough done. You get four downs to do whatever you want with. You don't have... There's no rule that you have to kick it on the fourth of those downs. You could do whatever you want from anywhere on the field on that fourth down. And they chose not to. They chose not to try to score. And I really think Pete Carroll just, he didn't take this game seriously. Like,
no, I don't buy that. But
he bought into the hype that the defense would give up 0 points. And this defense is not going to give up no points. They scored five fucking points, and they were so conservative on offense. You're like, close up shop. We've got five now.
The score's 5-0. Well, Pete Carroll's been coaching his whole career just to get to a 5-0 halftime lead.
Oh,
he must have been thrilled.
Was it 5-0 when they punted? Or was it?
No, I think that was 3-0 the when they punted. Safety.
It was awful. It was an awful decision. And it's probably the reason they lost this game. Like, and then they went for it later in a shorter yardage situation, but a worse situation where they ended up giving up points because they went for it. The likelihood that they would have given up points by going for it from the 37 was probably pretty low.
I mean, that's the reason to go for it, is you're in that gray area where it's too close to punt and too far to kick a field goal, and you should always go for it.
In this, I don't think the decision to go for it at midfield was wrong either, but like, they gave up points because of that decision to go for it. They were judging too much the distance and not enough where they were on the field. You also just have to be able to project what's going to happen in the future. And I think that they did a poor job of projecting what was going to happen in the future. Because when you're playing the Kansas City Chiefs, right, you be aggressive because you know what's going to happen is the Chiefs are going to score a fucking touchdown, right? Or you're never going to see the ball again. It's about, you have to assume that the other team is going to have success. If you're sitting back there and saying that your Seahawks defense that has been a bottom 10 defense the entire season is going to give up 0 points in a game, that is an absurd way of approaching a game plan. Because it's not based in facts at all. It's not based in prior experience. You're like, well, it's Colt fucking McCoy over there. Let's just take this for granted. Let's just punt. Right? Let's set up for later. And then
the later never comes. This for granted.
I think they were taking that the defense would get a stop for granted. Or that the defense wouldn't give up any points.
I think they were counting on it. I don't think they were taking it for granted. I think those are two different things.
If they got up 10-0 in this game, like if they would have gotten up by a touchdown, they'd probably win the game. And at no point were they able to. And I don't know how aggressive they were being in getting to that place. You can't say that the offense didn't do what you wanted them to do, Pete Carroll, but then also not put the offense in a position to be able to do what you want them to do.
I mean, the beauty of it is he can say that, it turns out.
You can say whatever the fuck he wants, and everybody will still blame Russell Wilson for some reason.
Let's talk about news. A belated toast. Josh Gordon, conditionally reinstated for week 16. Which would mean a 16-game suspension for Gordon dating back to last season. He'll be eligible to play in the last two games of the regular season if all goes to plan.
I will toast to nothing. what we don't know, you said earlier that he was suspended for a banned substance.
In addition to marijuana, yes.
If
it had just been marijuana, then you would think his suspension would have been, I don't know what the right term is here, but since the NFL has decided to no longer suspend for that, that was the basis of his appeal. And I think the league's position is that the PED was actually the significant part of that.
There is no reason that Kareem Hunt that Antonio Brown should be playing football and Josh Gordon shouldn't.
Also, in more immediate availability news, looking like Rashad Penny and Brandon Shell will return to practice this week. The Seahawks were down to their four-string right tackle by the end of this game as Chad Wheeler was out there after Cedric Oguehi was injured in practice. And
he was injured. That wasn't a scratch.
Yes. Oh, yes. He was injured.
I will get down on my knees and pray to see Brandon Shell back out there at right tackle.
It'll be good.
Lord.
All right. Should we talk about the Seahawks playing the other New York team, the New York Jets, on Sunday? The Jets missed their best chance at a win in 2020, but perhaps preserved their hopes of getting the number one pick with an improbable 31-28 loss to the Las Vegas Raiders at home on Sunday. Down 24-13 at the end of the third, the Jets went ahead 28-24 with 5:34 left and still had the same lead with 19 seconds left with the Raiders at their 46. Defensive coordinator Greg Williams sent a 7-man blitz and a cover zero after Derek Carr, who found Henry Ruggs one-on-one for the go-ahead touchdown. Williams was fired on Monday.
I mean, it's just... I love that Adam Gase had the ability to do this firing. It's like, dog, you've only got so much time. Why fire Greg Williams right now? Let your buddy get paid through the rest of the year, right? I understand that you had to make a sacrifice, but like, he did everybody in, I guess we'll say New York, he did everybody in New York a favor with that blitz. We may look back on this if Trevor Lawrence is the starting quarterback, all-pro quarterback for the New York Jets, and we may look back on this as the greatest moment in Jets history.
I mean, that's the thing about the national media is like they made it into like, ha, 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 Jets again. And it's like, no, if they had won, that would have been them Jetsing.
I mean, I was thinking about this. I was trying to put ourselves in the mind of a Jets fan. And I was like, we would be freaking out. We would have been so upset, right? If we're sitting there saying we're so excited about Trevor Lawrence coming, right? Like Trevor Lawrence... we've had once in a generation quarterbacks quite often lately, but like he is a let's say this. Trevor Lawrence seems to be a franchise saving quarterback. And
yes,
if it can't be once in a generation, if they're happening all the time, but like he seems like a quarterback who will be your starter.
This year's once in a generation quarterback,
Pro Bowl, all pro caliber quarterback. In New York, where they haven't really had one of those for...
Joe Namath, I think was the last one.
Look, there's some Pennington stands out there, myself included.
I love Chad Pennington, but he wasn't a franchise quarterback. 35-year-old Vinny Testaverde was not, which, by the way, I believe over the weekend was the anniversary of the Testaverde touchdown against the Seahawks.
And also the Almost Live sketch about it. But the John report or whatever...
No, it was Almost Live still.
Well, what was the segment called where he did the...
The John report. Yeah.
But if you have the chance to get a quarterback like Trevor Lawrence, like, you don't care about this game.
You don't not want it because of the fact that, oh, embarrassing, 0-16. Like, who cares about that for the Browns anymore?
Right? Like, give me all the 0-16s. I was thinking about that with the Browns, too. It was like... They're in a good position. They've got Myles Garrett, Baker Mayfield. Nobody's out there stressing about those losses from the days of yore. Losing is good. For lack of a better word, losing is good.
Sam Hinkie did nothing wrong.
Losing is great. Losing games is the best thing you can do. And if you're the Jets, if you're not making the playoffs, why do you care?
Exactly. 1-15 versus 0-16. It's not like nobody's got 0-16 lately. Like lots of teams have got 0-16.
Adam Gase is getting fired either way. Like I don't want to live in a world where Adam Gase gets to coach Trevor Lawrence.
I don't. Me neither.
That can't be a society that I live in.
Well, there's already a lot of reasons this can't be a society we live in. The Jets have actually been more competitive lately with 3-1 score losses in their last four games. The first two of those came with veteran Joe Flacco at quarterback. But in the last 2 weeks since his return from injury have been Sam Darnold's best two of the season by yards per attempt, albeit in limited opportunities. He completed 14 of 23 passes for 186 yards Sunday with two touchdowns and a pick. Still, Darnold has taken a step backwards after two uneven seasons to start his career. He ranks 31st of 31 qualifying quarterbacks in EPA per play and 30th in completion percentage over expectation by third Baldwin brother Ben Baldwin's metrics, ahead of Drew Locke.
I thought Drew Locke looked kind of nice on Sunday.
He did have a good game in that one. He certainly looked better than Kendall Hinton.
Oh, give me Drew Locke over Carson Wentz any day of the week.
Yeah, he, who is, by the way, 30th and 29th, respectively, in those two stats. Free Jalen Hurts. Ty Johnson, a 2019 sixth-round pick of the Lions who was claimed off waivers in October, took over the Jets' rushing game on Sunday and went 22 for 104 on the ground with a touchdown. Also got 8 carries for 74 yards from longtime practice squatter Josh Adams with just 1 carry Sunday for the ageless Frank Gore. Like, how long? You remember how long ago we watched Frank Gore tear up the Seahawks in the the Columbus Day Storm game? Or no, it wasn't Columbus Day. What day was that? Festivus Eve?
No.
It was Festivus Eve. It was December 22nd. I'm almost certain.
No, it definitely wasn't. It was like a school day.
I think 2022 would be that. December 22nd. No. What year was that?
It absolutely was not. It would have been 2008, I want to say.
Or maybe it was Hanukkah Eve. It was Hanukkah Eve. Is that the name of that windstorm?
It was a great windstorm. It was the biggest windstorm that I remember in my entire life.
I remember trying to go to lunch the next day when I was working at the Sonics offices, and all the places we went to were shut because they had no power.
We were like full in looting mode going to the Fred Meyer and Berrien. It was the biggest windstorm that I ever remember in my life. And you know, I stay in a windstorm. So I was pretty fired up about it.
Let's see, was this actually 2016 or 2006, December 14th, 2006, when he, the Seahawks lost to the 49ers 24-14 in Frank
It was
Gore.
Not. No, it was not 2006.
Okay. I was in too much.
Oh, you know what? Maybe it was 2006, actually.
There's only so many years it could have been that I was working for the Sonics.
Okay.
They moved. I don't know.
I was going to say because I was in my last year of college, but that would have been 2006. Right? Because the college season, much like the NBA season, spans 2 years.
It was only 29 for 144 in that game for Frank Gore. Not quite as dominant as I remember it in my head.
That windstorm was dominant, though.
It definitely was. It definitely
knocked
was.
Out the power everywhere. Like, Berrien was decimated.
Oh, boy.
Boulevard Park before they called it Berrien, too. All right, tell us more about the Jets.
For a terrible passing team, they have 3 surprisingly productive receivers and future post-Adam Gase breakout star Jamison Crowder, who's averaging 7.9 yards per target, Rashad Perriman at 9.4, and rookie Denzel Mims at 9.0 yards per target.
Say what you about Jamison Crowder. I've got Mims circled already as a sleeper for next year in fantasy.
There you go.
The Lawrence to Mims connection, you know it's going to be monster.
So why have the Jets been so bad passing? Because passes to tight ends have yielded 5.5 yards per target, and to running backs have yielded 4.9 yards per target. Assistant head coach Fred...
Can you imagine throwing the ball through the air to Frank Gore? In the year 2020.
A lot of those targets are to Kalen Ballage, who has been on the Chargers for a long time now.
He started the season on the Jets?
He did, yes. Assistant head coach Frank Bush, who works with inside linebackers, will replace Greg Williams, is the interim defensive coordinator for the Jets. His previous defensive coordinator experience came with the Texans in 2009 and 2010. Before Sunday's game, the Jets were 8th in rush defense DVOA, but 32nd out of 32 teams in pass defense. The 381 yards they gave up to Derek Carr probably did not change that. The Jets couldn't cover Darren Waller, who went 13 catches and 17 targets for 200 yards and 2 touchdowns.
He was wide open on every single play.
It was really frustrating if you were playing against Darren Waller in fantasy.
Oh, come on.
Jimmer, you know.
You could have taken out, in fact, crunch the numbers. You could have taken out Waller's score, changed it to a zero, and you still would have lost.
I don't think that is true. The Jets have allowed the most yards per play or per target at 8.7 yards per target to tight ends this season. So could be a big day for the thrill of Jacob Hollister.
It's been, I actually had the thought yesterday that the Seahawks may be missing Greg Olsen.
I don't think that's I think they definitely are. And you are correct, by the way. I lost by 50 points to Jimmer. So the 45 from Darren Waller would not have covered it because he also had Devontae Adams and Deontay Johnson. And he still has Greg Zuerlein to go. My God. He's got a 179 and he just has Greg Zuerlein left.
Fucker.
So sacks aren't everything, but fun fact. Jamal Adams, 7.5 sacks, or more than any of his former Jets teammates. Quinnen Williams, who has 6 in a breakout second season, is the only Jets player with more than 2 sacks this season.
And I got to say, I think Jamal Adams looks great.
He doesn't look bored, no matter what Greg Williams had to say. It's sad that Jamal Adams won't get a revenge game against Greg Williams.
They played Jamal Adams the way that the Jets would have played Jamal Adams, though.
Oh, like, yeah, for sure.
They took Jets things from Jamal Adams. Like, I'll give them credit for that.
Took is too strong.
But I don't think, I think that Jamal Adams can do everything. I think it would be a misnomer to say that Jamal Adams can't cover, and his ability in pressuring the quarterback is huge. Like, I feel like I'm willing to take an L on Jamal Adams, or at least from midseason. Like, he looks like he matters a little bit, and especially as far as getting pass rush goes, I think that he is a difference maker.
All right, so the concern in this game, it's obviously not the New York Jets. It's the fact that the weather is going to turn in Seattle. And the forecast for Sunday calls for rain showers and about a 50% chance of rain throughout the game window.
I'll be curious to see how that looks. I mean, you do have the 32nd best pass coverage team in the NFL. I'm not willing to admit that Russell Wilson won't be able to pass the ball in this game. I think that they are going to come out with the expectation to run the fucking ball. Because again, Pete Carroll is, if nothing else, reactionary. And I'm sure that he looked at that game and he said to Brian Schottenheimer, run the fucking ball. He probably wore his hat to the to the team meetings, right? Like, this is, they Carroll are going.
You would never use profanity like that.
Run the damn ball, sorry. They're probably going to come out with a little bit. I mean, but we've been saying this all year and it hasn't happened yet. So I do have to, if nothing else, say that Pete Carroll has been pretty committed to letting Russ cook. For better or worse, Pete Carroll has been committed to letting Russ cook. So they're gonna run the ball in this game. And if they can run and get enough out of the pass, I feel like this is going to be one of those games where everything just goes according to plan. And they run, they complete passes, they pick up some third downs for the first time ever. And I think finally the Seahawks win a semi-comfortable game.
Chances of victory?
God, I don't know. I still think it's about 85%.
Yeah. That's where I am. That may be too pessimistic. So now should we talk about Husky football?
All right, emergency pod number 3.
Ugh. You know, I tried to rationalize the Huskies' 31-26 loss on Saturday to Stanford by saying, oh, well, it probably doesn't matter because Oregon will beat Cal. And then, you know, it would have been just the same for the Huskies anyway. They have to beat Oregon no matter what. But Oregon did not beat Cal. The Huskies could have clinched the Pac-12 North on Sunday if they would have beat Stanford.
Wait, let me rationalize the Huskies' loss to Stanford.
Okay.
There we go.
Wait, you're going for another beer? Because let me tell you, the thing about this B-bomb is usually we split it because we're in person, and 22 ounces of the B-bomb is a lot.
It actually went down very smooth. I shared some
with smooth.
I shared some with Mrs. Fantasy Genius.
It's just heavy.
I did not drink 22 ounces. I mean, it is when you get it at the Urban Beer Garden at Fremont, they poured in, I want to say, you can get it in like 4, 6, or 8 ounce pours, right? That like a small, right. Small pours that they give you. And usually you get like another beer, right? You just find the sourest beer possible on the menu. And then, and it's the apple cup and you're just fired up because you're around other human beings, breathing their droplets. And where was I going with this?
I don't know where you were going with this, but the point is that you haven't had 22 ounces of it.
No, I have not. Your rationalization still was fine, but it ultimately doesn't change things for the Huskies. Like,
no, it does, because again, they would have had the Pac-12 North wrapped up.
It does, and going to the Pac-12 championship would mean something, but like going to the Pac-12 championship at 2-2, just come on, you know.
But if they had beat Stanford, they would have gone at 3-1.
I guess that's true.
That's
yeah.
the point.
But
or
4-1.
They're actually 3-1 currently. They're not 2-1.
You want to beat Oregon, like.
I mean, without question, you want to beat Oregon.
You need to beat Oregon. I don't love falling backwards into the Pac-12 championship. I want to go out there and beat Oregon.
I don't love needing to beat Oregon to go to the Pac-12 championship.
No, bring it on. Bring it on. Look, what's our record against Oregon in the last 15 years?
Oh, it's great. It's
pretty good, right?
There was that Craig Chambers game that was just a minute ago.
Very
recent.
I love your topics are Saturday. Because this is a reaction pod.
I mean, the topic is just shoe is bad. And the problem is people don't know why it was bad. And I think
I know why it was
lose
bad.
The coaching staff.
Oh, what is the chatter coming out of this game? Because you see the shit more than I do. What? Like when you say that,
chatter is the Seahawks' inability to stop their run at the Seahawks. Huskies. The Huskies' inability to stop their run. And the problem is, like, their run defense was not good.
An issue.
But the fact that Davis Mills
completed... You fucking told me... Okay.
Every third down pass was a much bigger issue.
I mean, we fought about this game for so long on Saturday that I'm not all thought out. Look, there's more. But I still think this was a scenario of... Look, the Husky defense didn't play a good game. And I thought that this was a stat that Christian Cable brought up, right? The success rate of Stanford. Because success rate is really all that matters. That's what we should be looking at in these goddamn box scores. Like, if
you're
running... That
was the argument we were having 2 weeks ago about, like, big plays versus consistent success.
No. You were just like, if you run the ball every time for 3 yards per carry, you were still talking yards per carry. If you told me...
Turns out the Huskies lost the Craig Chambers game. He had 4 catches for 106 yards, and yet they still lost 31-6.
You're nostalgic for games that they actually lost.
In 2004, when Kellen Clemens went 21 of 34 for 134 yards.
Wow, Colt McCoy would have done better. You didn't cite to me... You didn't say to me, if a team has 100% success rate on every play, they would win every game. Of fucking course. What you said was yards per carry. And yards per carry is ultimately horseshit. Because yards per carry, it's an average.
No, I said consistent success.
Consistent success is great, but an average. I would rather have a lower yards per carry, but a higher success rate. And that's what Stanford had in this game. they didn't have monster plays running the ball. They had successful plays running the ball. And that's the issue with this Husky defense.
They didn't actually have that many successful plays. So there's a difference between
Every single play they ran was successful.
Christian Campbell's estimate of their success rate was different than the college football scrapers' estimate of their success rate.
All right. Wow.
So I don't know what to tell you there. I don't know what the discrepancy is. But CFB Scrapar had them much lower. And again, the most successful plays were the 9 of 11 completions on third and fourth down by Davis Mills that all went for first downs. And a first down in those situations is by default a successful play.
I agree. I mean, I think that Davis Mills played an incredible game. Like,
I mean, the question is whether it's Davis Mills was just so great, which there were a few balls, like the completion up the sideline that Keith Taylor was in perfect position and it was just kind of dropped in the bucket. Like there was nothing you can do with the defense. That was about Davis Mills making a play and his receiver. But there were a couple of those.
You might have to specify a little bit more. This was the deep ball that looked like it might've been an incompletion.
No, the one on the sideline. I don't remember the receiver.
They were both on the sideline. The one was to the right sideline that basically ended the game.
The left sideline.
And then the one to the left sideline that was down to like the two were Keith Taylor like pulled it out.
Right. But it was a completion.
It was probably a completion. I think refereeing was a little bit questionable in this game, but we're just going to leave that there.
Well, I mean, it was a Pac-12 game.
It wasn't. That was not the issue. The issue was that it wasn't equal on both sides. I don't have an issue with the Huskies secondary, even though Davis Mills played well. They're still a good secondary, and they still played a pretty good game. Like, when you look at it process-wise, the Huskies secondary played a good game. They didn't make repeatable mistakes here.
I mean, if you take out the Arizona game, the Huskies secondary has not been that good. Overall, over the course of the season, in opponent pass EPA, they have the fourth worst. They're ninth out of 12 teams in the Pac-12.
Really? They may have why are we always looking at the wrong fucking stats? You're looking at Oregon, you got the wrong EPA than Christian Capel, you don't have the right success rate for Chris Carson. Like, what the hell is going on?
They're again, the B-bomb is very strong. They're fourth best, but a lot of that is the Arizona game.
God, the machine, am I right? You're like the freaking Spotify wrapped algorithm over here, right? Like you say it's a computer, but you're not really sure. The secondary is good.
I just have a hard time being upset at the secondary.
And I still have a hard time. This is like, it really is like a Russell Wilson issue, vice versa, right? And I just still think that the secondary and the defense ultimately are probably ahead of the Husky offense.
But and in terms of FPI efficiency, that is not the case. In terms of EPA, you know who has the most efficient offense in the Pac-12 this season by EPA?
Right here. And that is Dylan fucking Morris, baby. You know who it is. It is Demo to CO. That is the Husky offense.
The Huskies do have the highest pass EPA per
right
play
now.
In the
Dylan
Pac-12.
Morris, I swear to God. Dylan Morris is the best freshman quarterback we have seen in Husky history. Dylan Morris looks good, right? Like that game good. That he played, Dylan Morris has a feel in the pocket. He's hitting receivers. He hit deep balls. Dylan Morris is doing everything right back there. And
Ty Jones was doing a lot of work on those deep balls, but yes.
There was definitely the one that he went up and grabbed one-handed, but like, this is Dylan Morris working with Ty Jones and Ty Jones and Ty Jones and Ty Jones. Like, this is Dylan Morris without his number two, maybe even his number one and number two receivers. Look, I love Romo Dunze. This is not a question about whether he's a good receiver, but like, Terrell Bynum ain't walking through that door.
Also, Cade Otton is the number one option.
Okay.
Let's be clear.
There was Cade. But like, Dylan Morris had a very efficient game.
He did.
With missing two of his top receivers, two of his three top receivers. Dylan Morris is...
He's playing well.
He is the quarterback who is going to lead the Huskies back to their next college football playoff when it expands to 32 teams.
It's a little difficult to square that EPA with the fact that he is ninth in QBR in the Pac-12, but there is, I would say, not substantial difference between fifth through ninth.
Dylan Morris looked great in this game. And you know what didn't look great? It's written right here in my hat. Look, right there. Don't run the damn ball. Like, they ran the ball fucking horribly in this game. They had a couple of okay plays to McGrew. Otherwise, it was terrible. They're bad at running. They are a bad running team, and they continue to try running. They were running the ball when they were down how many points? They were running the ball when they were down 21. They were running the ball when they were down 15. They were running the ball when they were down 8 on 2nd and 20. This is an offense that is all wrong.
I don't know if it's all wrong.
The way that they structure the offense is all wrong. And I'll tell you, I came up with a phrase. Brand new. Might not have heard it. You know? Bit of an innovator. Let Dylan Morris cook. Let the man pass the ball because he's good at passing the ball. He's the best quarterback we have seen at passing since everybody in Husky history. This is the best passer because also it's 2020 and all the passers in the last 30 years were terrible in hindsight. Look, the completion percentage is horrible. Even when they were good, they were bad. Dylan Morris is the best passer in Husky history. And you're out here on 2nd and 20 handing it off up the middle. Like, this was the drives that they had to close this game were the least efficient drives I have ever seen a football team have. They're out there with 3 carries down 21, 3 carries to pick up a first down. That's not what you do. And then they pass the ball and boom, 40 yards, boom, 30 yards, boom, there's Kate Otten. Like, the passing offense is excellent and they don't even know what they have on their hands. That's what's so frustrating about it. I don't think they really realize just how good Dylan Morris and this passing offense has been this year.
I think that's true. Sean McGrew's success rate on Saturday was a solid 56%.
That's not solid.
Yeah, it's
in college,
the
you're the one who tells me how good it is to run in college, but then you're like, well, 56% success rate. They can't both be true. You can't have low standards and high standards at the same
Stanford's
time.
Stanford's success rate was around 51% by the same measure. So Sean McGrew was more successful.
That cannot be true.
I'll double check it, but that's what I remember.
But also, not every carry was with Sean McGrew. That's the other thing that people don't get.
That is very true.
People are out there quoting Chris Carson's yards per carry, but forget that Carlos Hyde had 2 carries for 1 yard. What was Dylan Morris's success rate? How many yards per attempt did he average, right? Like, they just structured it all wrong, and I don't believe that it is a coincidence that this team has gotten way down, has been bailed out 2 consecutive games by Dylan Morris being borderline excellent in 2 second halves. And he is making these passes. He's blossoming right in front of us, and I think everybody else is seeing it except for John Donovan and Jimmy Lake. And I do have to say, Donovan has taken a lot of criticism, but I it's always hard to tell how much of the run v pass distribution is up to the coordinator versus the coach. Even if they're not specifically saying run this play, pass this play, I think there's an expectation if your defensive coach, Jimmy Lake, you want to start your offense. You want to base your offense around running the ball. And that's the way it is for basically every defensive coach in history. And I think that John Donovan, I don't know if we could just say that John Donovan is that this would be the ideal offense that he's running. But as far as open receivers downfield, I think we're seeing a lot more of them than we were seeing last year under Bush Hamden with Jacob Eason as 4th round draft pick. Because he's tall and white at quarterback.
I don't think you can judge someone just because of the fact that they're a defensive-minded coach. I think that's unfair. You have to judge everyone individually.
have yet to see a defensive-minded coach. Well, I don't know. Belichick, I guess you would say, is defensive-minded coach, right?
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Okay. I think we came to that a lineman-minded coach has probably not been that successful, but...
Well, a lineman-minded coach on the other side did lead the team to the Rose Bowl last season.
And fucking hamstrung Justin Herbert. Like, we have a Herbert who's a breakout star in the NFL, kind of bad in college.
I don't know what to make of that, but let's talk a little bit more.
We're not moving on yet. We have to talk about fourth downs, and I know you don't want to do this, but Jimmy Lake's fourth down decisions in this game were god awful, especially in the first half. When to go?
Typical of a coach
who what wasn't trying to score points.
No, just typical of a
didn't realize that typical of a coach, period.
It was the end of the sentence.
Typical of a coach, end sentence. They were typical of a coach who didn't recognize that Stanford scored touchdowns on the first three possessions and would have scored a touchdown on the fourth possession if they'd had more time and maybe even wasn't aggressive enough. Like, when you see David Shaw on the other side, any scenario that you have in your life, no matter what you're doing, anything.
I mean, David Shaw went for a 1 fourth down. Let's chill the fuck out here.
If you're in your life, any scenario, look, you see a burrito on the floor of your car. It's been a week. Should I eat it? Should I not? If David Shaw would eat that burrito, you should be eating that burrito. That is... any scenario in your life.
Eat the burrito under no circumstances.
Look, eat around the sour cream. You'll be fine. If there is a scenario in your life that David Shaw is more aggressive than you, you are doing everything wrong. Restart. Tear it all down and start over from the beginning. Because there should not be a scenario that David Shaw is more aggressive than you are. And that's what's going on with this Husky football team. They are punting when they should not be punting. And... it is costing the team points on offense. Again, this is starting from the point of they do not understand what they have on their hands with Dylan Morris. And they're costing
Dylan Morris has played quite well.
They're costing the team points, though. These are points that matter. Like, this is a game where how many stops did the defense come up with? There was one punt and one turnover, is that right? Or did they reach two punts?
I think there was one punt.
One punt and one fumble. So if you were to go into this game and say, Stanford's only going to punt the ball one time and they're only going to fumble one time, you know what you would do? You wouldn't fucking punt the ball, right? You wouldn't say, oh, we've got a 4th and 4 from midfield, positive territory.
But that was the second drive of the game. You didn't know yet that Stanford was going to be that successful offensively. I don't think it was reasonable to expect them to be that successful offensively. Stanford went for 2 fourth downs.
What about the second time? They went for 2 fourth downs? Look, Jimmy Lake is trembling. 2 fourth downs?
They probably should have went for the second fourth down, but it was 4th and 6. It was not like an obvious. It wasn't like they punted on 4th and 1.
And what happened? They punted and Stanford was back at their territory in a second. This is not the offense Jimmy Lake thinks it is, and it's not the defense Jimmy Lake thinks it is either.
Stanford went for 2 fourth downs, a 4th and 4 from the Washington 36 and a 4th and 1 from the Washington 12.
They got, and then also they got.
Sure, you're not guaranteed of getting 4th downs, as it turns out. The 4th downs are not like you go for it and you automatically get it. You gain like 10% of the time.
10%?
Yes. Because that's the net of when you get it versus when you don't get it. It's like 10% net. Yeah. It's not 100%. It's not how it works.
I don't think it's 100%.
It's not a cheat code in a video game. It's not like you entered up, down, left, right, up, down.
You really, really sound like a radio broadcaster right now. I'm Brock Heward, and I'm here to say punting is good. Look, it's not like you get it every time. You don't say up, down, left, right, up, down.
I mean, you should do it if it's even 1%.
You should do it if even make it. You should do it if it's the right thing to do statistically. If it's a greater,
you should do it.
Then
if it's even 1% better, but you shouldn't overstate the value of it because then you get, well, the Seahawks went for it at 4-1 and they didn't get it. The other team's going to touch it.
I don't care. That's the thing that you don't understand. I don't give a fuck about what the people on the internet say. I don't know. Look, I'm Joe Biden's campaign, and my whole thing is about treating Twitter like it's not real life. Right? Look, I read the
story.
Well,
my whole thing is about treating stats
like they're
legitimate. Your
whole thing is like saying Bernie's going to win after he won the first three states. That's you. That's what you're about, is you're about saying that Twitter is real life. You care so much about what the people on the internet say. You don't care at all what's happening in the real world. And what I care about is winning the fucking game.
Well, the real world is you don't get 100% of fourth downs.
I don't know. It's not about getting 100% of fourth downs. It's about maximizing your...
But it's not that big a difference. It's a very small difference at the end of the day.
No, that play is a small difference, but what about the play after that? And the play after that and the play after that?
No, because the play after that you don't necessarily get. So no, you don't get to argue that.
What is the difference between the play that comes back on the other end? Like, you'll give up a touchdown either way. So it doesn't matter. Like, they just...
I don't think that it's reasonable to expect that the UW defense is going to give up 80% on third and fourth downs going forward. Like, that's not a consistent thing.
There was some bad luck at bay in both games, but maybe you push your luck a little bit.
You should have gone for more fourth downs. But it's not a guarantee of success. It's not going to turn a loss
for
win.
Worrying about what internet commenter said, what Laker fan fucking 2020 says about the game, right? Laker
but you fan, can't go in there saying as if you're always going to be successful on fourth down either.
Why
you have to
are you
acknowledge randomness.
Look, you should go into the game and you should say to yourself, I am a robot. I have no opinion about anything other than the stats tell me I should go for this fourth down, or the stats tell me I should not go for this fourth down.
Okay, but that's not a realistic expectation of any coach, because no coach thinks that way, because robots don't coach any team.
Why can't a coach think that way? Why?
It's just not a realistic expectation.
There's
like, you're going to be upset about every coach if you're treating a coach as if they're a robot.
God, a robot coach would be so good. You're out here making...
The thing about the robot coaches, they would say an equal amount about how many injuries they have as actual college coaches.
You're out here...
Can we move past this? Can we talk about the special teams and how fucking bad they are?
Okay, great. The special teams are bad. The defense is bad. The offense doesn't maximize what they do best. There is nothing good about this fucking football team.
I mean,
you're out here fucking defending Jimmy Lake because I think that Jimmy Lake's tenure as Husky head coach has been an unmitigated disaster. And
we're talking about a coach that has lost one game in the history of his entire time as a coach.
The most incredible thing is that I'm able to judge process and outcomes. I judge process good or bad. And
shockingly,
in fact,
the Huskies have moved up in special teams after last week. They moved up from 127th out of 127 in the country to 125th. And I don't get why they are so bad at special teams.
You told me you didn't even care where the team won the game. You remember this like 3 years ago? It's the douchiest thing you ever said. You were like, I don't care where they win or lose. All I care about is process. Oh, and I hated you for saying it. And
I mostly care about whether the team does well in the classroom and is preparing their players for life.
Oh, we can all laugh because it's so ridiculous. Oh, Baby Fantasy Genius got NBA 2K21 this week, and they have real college programs in that game. They've got West Virginia, they've got Syracuse, they've got Gonzaga even. And to me, the most incredible thing about it is that the profits that they're making by licensing the branding from the program to that game is the players are being paid for that. Hold on a second here. I'm being told. No, they're getting jack shit from it. Okay, sorry. The program is benefiting totally from that. Okay, got it.
Getting high quality facilities.
You were fucking high quality facilities. Ooh, I love that. I like that.
I mean, that's not as good as the players getting the choice.
Bring it on, Softy.
It's not as good as the players getting a choice of what they want to do with that revenue.
Better. Let's just say it. Russell Wilson has to be better. Give me some Chris Dantas. That's you right now. That is you. High quality facilities. Come on. Bellevue High School, get the fuck out of here.
You're
look,
really,
let's just say,
really
let's just say
the hell out of that straw man.
Let's just say it. Let's just say it. Jim Moore would have been a better coach. Anyway.
That straw man is taking a beating, as it turns out.
All emergency pods, let's get after it.
If you're talking about Oregon.
Oh, Lord. Yes.
So this game is for the Pac-12 North Championship.
Hello.
Oregon hoping to salvage a season that began with college football playoff hopes. After back-to-back losses at Oregon and State and Cal, the Ducks weren't exactly dominant through a 3-0 start. They cruised past the Stanford team, unexpectedly playing without Davis Mills due to contact tracing for a false positive test, as we talked about last week. But then we're in one possession games in the final 5 minutes at
they
Wazoo.
They didn't have to play
again,
Davis Mills. Wait, are no, we taking didn't. A step back here? He just didn't no. even play?
I mean, look.
Did you tell me that last week when I was judging
I
the
did.
Game?
I did, and again, at UCLA, 2020, I don't know what to tell you.
Lord.
The Ducks still ranked 23rd in terms of FPI efficiency. The Huskies, after last week, dropped to 62nd in that metric.
Jimmy.
Don't blame Tyler Shuck for Oregon's issues. He's averaging 9.7 yards per attempt as a passer and 4.9 yards per carry this season. He is number 4 in the Pac-12 in QBR with a better rating. than Justin Herbert had last season. I don't know how that's possible.
Look, I think college QBR is just insane. Like, you cannot trust it.
It's based on the same principles. I don't know, like, why you can't. Like, obviously, it's influenced by other factors, including your teammates and your coaching staff. But
it's just for whatever reason, even college performance. I think maybe. I don't know.
The Ducks have improved from 20th in FPI efficiency last year to 17th so far this year.
This is a better Ducks offense than last year?
Obviously, that's not all about Shuck, who did have his worst outing on Saturday with going 14 of 26 for 231 yards. The Ducks have their usual complement of skill position talent. Jalen Redd and Devin Williams, both in the top 10 in Pac-12, receiving the EPA. Williams, the big play threat, averaging 20.3 yards per reception and 13.6 per target. Well, Redd is a bit steadier, catching 70% of targets. Oregon starting running back CJ Verdell had just 6 carries versus Cal after leaving the Oregon State game with injury, but hasn't really been playing that well, not as well as backup Travis Dye. Anyway, Dye leads the Ducks running backs in rushing EPA and has been a home run hitter out of the backfield, catching 3 touchdowns on his 7 targets this season, as well as a 67-yarder last week that did not go to the house.
Yeah, he's scary. Travis Dye.
100%. You don't want to see him in the backfield. So why have the Ducks struggled? Well, it's mostly because their defense has dropped from 8th in FPI last season to 56th in FPI efficiency this year. Last week was the first time they've held an opponent to fewer than 400 total yards or 5.5 yards per play.
Have they lost many players?
We'll get to that. They gave up 532 yards to Oregon State in the rivalry formerly known as the Civil War, more than twice as many as the Huskies allowed. In terms of rush defense, EPA have been worse than the Huskies per play, which is surprising because from what I'm told, the Huskies' rush defense is the only problem with the team. They lost nearly half of their 2019
Speaking
starts on
straw
defense,
man.
Including Travis's brother, Troy Dye, who was a 4th-round pick by the Vikings, and 3 opt-outs ahead of the NFL draft own the secondary. Safety Javon Holland, a possible 1st-round pick, fellow safety Brady Breeze, and cornerback Thomas Graham
Jr. It's almost
Jr.
like you don't want to be paid $0 to play football during a pandemic.
It feels like the pass rush for Oregon is underachieved. Kayvon Thibodeau, who was the Pac-12 Defensive Freshman of the Year last year, has just 2 sacks after 9 as a freshman. He's still tied with the team lead with Noah Sewell, who is the younger brother of tackle Penei Sewell, a likely top 5 pick who also opted out. That's what your chances of victory is.
That's every
Shrug
game.
Emoji.
I it really is every college game, right? Like, we don't know who the Huskies are. We don't know who Oregon is. That's it. Did I see a report, Baby Fantasy Genius? And look, I question some of the accuracy of some of the statements that he tells me. He told me that he saw that Elijah Molden is going to exit the program after the Pac-12 championship, should it be played.
I mean, I haven't seen anything specifically about that, but I would think so. I mean, he went through senior day festivities.
But that would mean that he would not play any potential bowl game, be it Zaxby's Heart of Dallas Bowl or otherwise.
Not something I've seen again.
Okay. I just, there's not a lot that we know about either team. You know, the sample size is small. I guess what we do know is that we know that Oregon is not the team that they were last year and maybe even the last couple of years. And we know that the defense is a little bit faulty. We don't know what home field advantage means in this game. And I think we don't know a ton about Tyler Shuck or Dylan Morris, to be honest.
It's worth noting this will be the first road game for the Huskies. They have played every game at home thus far. So that's going
to
be
interesting. Where's the Pac-12 championship game going to be played?
That's a great question. I think it's in Vegas.
Not Santa Clara.
Yeah, probably not Santa Clara. That's a good point. That is a good point. But I believe it was moving to Vegas this year anyway.
Okay. You know, it's such a difficult thing to judge, despite the fact that we're going to be at mid-December by the time that this game is played. Really, the quality of these two teams, I still think that the Huskies are better. But it'll probably come down to third downs. And if they can get off the field, then I think they'll probably win this game. Oh, and if they can't, they won't.
Oh. 2020 will be hosted by the home team, so therefore it's going to be USC unless they lose.
It's just so much of it comes down to these third down plays, you know, across all of football, and whatever that looks like, you know, I think people really underestimate how much that has to do with it. You know, really the entire sport is based off of explosive plays and getting lucky on one random down. So I think it's a very tough thing to judge. And the Huskies were on the wrong side of the grain last week, but I don't think it was predictive of what will happen this week, how successful Stanford was on third down last week. You know, Stanford made third down plays that most teams should not be expected to make as consistently as they made them.
Did I hear a percentage in there?
I think the percentage is 50%.
Wow. Okay. I'm going 35. I still think Oregon is the better team and isn't at home. So I'm going 35.
You think Oregon is the better team?
I do,
yes. You take each roster, you put them on a neutral field. Do you think Oregon's the better team?
Yes.
I can't get there to that. I mean, we're talking about a team that they just straight up lost to fucking Oregon State and Cal. Like,
they did. Those were both on the road.
Which is do you really think that matters?
A little.
We don't know. Like, it's impossible to judge in this season. I think top to bottom, the Husky roster is probably more talented than the Oregon roster. Probably very close. They're probably the two most talented rosters in the Pac-12 North, which is why it's fun that this is going to decide the Pac-12. I'm sure it'll be an extraordinarily close game, and if I know anything about football, especially in the city of Seattle, it'll be
frustrating,
really depressing. Yeah. The Huskies will lose at the end.
Or let's stick with UW sports and talk about basketball for a bit. You know, women's basketball crushed Cal 80-53 on
Friday. We are a UW women's basketball podcast. That's right, baby.
Behind 21 points from Tamia Sadler in her Pac-12 debut. It was a close game through the third quarter before the Huskies outscored the Bears 30-13 in the final period. Much of it was Sadler on the bench. But the previously undefeated UW women's basketball team suffered a reality check Sunday against number 2 Stanford in a game played at Thomas and Mack Center in Las Vegas, suffering a 83-50 loss. Is Sadler shot 2 of 10
closer than the score indicated.
The Huskies were outscored 23-4 in the second quarter. Haley Jones went off for 29 points on 14 of 15 shooting in 27 minutes, adding 13 rebounds. The Husky women are scheduled to play at home for the first time this weekend, hosting WSU on Friday in Portland in the final scheduled non-conference game on Sunday. The Cougs were unable to make their trip to the Bay Area last weekend due to having fewer than 7 scholarship players through COVID-19 tests and contact tracing and have yet to play this season.
Okay, but if we're being honest, I can understand the logic. Like, can they have walk-ons or do they not have walk-ons on the team?
They may have some walk-ons, but I think the idea is that you need more than 7 players plus walk-ons to be able to play a game.
I understand the logic in football because it's a physical sport and you don't want people to get injured. This is basketball. They should let anybody play. Right? Like, if you can field a team, you should be able to play.
I don't think they should let anyone play.
You don't agree with that logic? If they have fewer than 7 players, let 5 players play plus some walk-ons. It's basketball, right? Like, if you were playing a fucking game of basketball and they're like, hey, sorry, I hate to break this to you. You have to play the entire game, no matter how shitty you are. I'd be like, I'm going to shoot the rock, baby. I'm going to, like...
You would be getting a flagrant foul. We know your history.
I'm going to be like, you want me to fire some threes? I'm on it. You'd be out there being like, look, I will do nothing else but get offensive rebounds. I am all about it.
Right?
But if somebody told me, no matter how many shots you missed, you will never come out of the game. I'd be like, that is what I'm looking for.
Sign me up.
I'm in. And for you, it'd be no matter how few shots you take, you will never come out of the game.
But how many lamps you miss.
Oh, Lord. I love how our basketball personalities align with our podcast personalities.
It really is. You know, men's basketball coming off a 76-62 loss in their Pac-12 opener Thursday at Utah. The important news, the Seattle Times reported on Sunday that N'Zaiah Carter's suspension for violation of the school's intercollegiate athletics code was because of findings that Carter violated the student conduct code regarding sexual assault, defined as, quote, sexual contact with another person without or that exceeds that person's consent. Two separate complaints were lodged against Carter, one in January and a second in March. The first hearing was held in late July and concluded in finding of a violation in October before Carter's suspension. He subsequently appealed that ruling, but it was upheld on Wednesday with a punishment of 3-quarter suspension for winter, spring, and summer quarters 2021. A second hearing resulted in November filing a violation that was not appealed by Carter, who announced on Friday that he was leaving the school to turn pro. Before that report from the Seattle Times on Saturday, ESPN Australia had reported that Carter was going to sign with Melbourne United as part of the NBL's Next Stars program that previously bought LaMelo Ball to Australia. But follow-up reporting Sunday indicated that after the findings against Carter became public, that offer was rescinded by the NBL.
So, yeah, I'm pretty good with that.
It would have been really troubling if he was able to evade the suspension by just going and playing professional basketball this year. So,
I mean, at that point, that's the decision of those programs. You know, I don't think it makes sense for somebody to police what, you know, a professional franchise is going to do in Australia or whatever, but like, as far as the University of Washington is concerned, I think this is the right decision.
For sure. Those findings came to light only after one of the students who reported Carter posted about them on Twitter with a statement. We, as the victims, feel that the university has failed to act in a way that protects and supports us. They have also failed to notify the public of his behavior, neglecting to protect future victims and victims who never had the chance to seek justice.
I mean, this is the first that I'm learning of this, so I think that has to be true.
Well, I mean, he was found, like, again, the hearings found him guilty on both counts, so.
But we're talking about, okay, these were complaints that were lodged a significant amount of time ago.
And correct, the fact he was that allowed to play after these complaints were lodged as the investigations were unfolding. The first investigation concluded in April before the hearing in July.
The idea that a college program is good at conducting these investigations is absurd, and that they're even necessarily prepared for conducting these investigations is absurd also. And I think it's fundamentally why sports and a university environment should be separate from each other. You know, I don't really understand how the two are linked whatsoever. And
well, I don't know if the professional league is better at handling this sort of thing. I guess I would say that.
I think that they are probably better at it, but
they're probably more responsive to the public will.
I just don't think a university is prepared to handle this. You know, I don't think that a university is prepared to handle the type of scrutiny that is going to happen of a person who is, you know, for all intents and purposes, a professional athlete. And the fact that they were, that Nas Carter hearing this, again, I'm reacting in the moment. This is the first that I've heard of this. This did not blow up on Twitter. This wasn't like you were saying about the Sounders game. This wasn't like a thing that flooded Twitter with responses. Literally reading this is the first time that I'm seeing this information. And I think that that is troubling unto itself. But, you know, maybe I can blame myself for being unaware of that, right? For being ignorant of that information. But if you hear a complaint, boom, you're suspended. That's it. Like, I think that that's a pretty simple thing to do. You know, if at the very least, if you want to have a level of credibility to it, if you feel like a complaint is credible, you shouldn't have that player playing for your team after that. And especially as a school that's receiving money from the state, having a person playing basketball games for you after that point doesn't really make sense to me.
Yeah.
I mean, at the very least, is you're allowing due process to happen, right? You just...
You're not, by suspending someone, proactively preventing due process from happening.
No. Certainly. Yeah, you just suspend the player and you let due process happen. I don't know if that due process needs to take, say, 6 months, as it seems to have taken, but there was a pandemic during that time period.
Including the appeal, 9 months.
And I think that that could have been expedited. But again, I just think that a university is fundamentally incapable of handling this as a scenario. And that's why these two things should be completely separate. Like, what they are doing is they are essentially fielding a professional basketball program, and they are fielding they're overseeing a higher education institution. These are two completely separate things. And a professional basketball program could respond to an accusation such as this quickly, and they could expedite it. It wouldn't take them, like you were saying, 9 months to make this decision both public and to come to a conclusion about it. And
I mean, again, it was only public because of the fact that the victim posted it.
And that's even more sickening, to be honest. Like,
I mean, there's some, we don't know what kind of the legal restrictions are on the university in this regard.
This reeks to me of trying to avoid public attention responsibility, though. And that's just, these two things shouldn't be related. Like, at its core, a fucking university shouldn't have to think about this. You know, they shouldn't have to think about
it. A university should have to think about how they to handle sexual assault on campus. Yes, they should absolutely have to
think about that. They should have to think about that, but they shouldn't have to think about it as it's a public relations thing. Right? Like, they should have to think about it as if they were ignoring. And I think that the fact that Nas Carter is a basketball player changed how this was being responded to.
I can't speak to that, but
like, there's no oversight whatsoever. And there never will be any oversight. It's just the whole system is completely broken at its core.
So on the court for the Huskies.
Lord.
A more promising start in their Pac-12 opener, which they led 21-14 at one point, slipped away as Utah rallied with a 15-2 run and turned a close game into a rout with a 14-18 run in the second half. The Huskies went nearly 6 minutes without scoring during that run. The outside shooting was again a struggle for the Huskies, who went 6 of 30 on threes. They made just 6 free throws in the game. Didn't improve dramatically on the glass, where Nate Roberts had a career-high 13 rebounds. Quade Green, with 21 points on 8 of 18 shooting, was the only real offensive threat. USC transfer Jerron Brooks was mostly replaced in the rotation by 7'4" former walk-on Riley Sorn, who played pretty well. Cole Bajima also got minimal minutes, but did not really make an impact in that game. The Huskies host Seattle U on Wednesday in the first matchup for both of those teams in Seattle this season. The Redhawks opened with wins over struggling Portland and NAIA school William Jessup in Portland, then split 2 games in Vegas, beating Air Force but losing to Cal State Northridge. Over the weekend, they were crushed 78-52 at UCLA on Thursday night before losing 80-75 at Long Beach State on Sunday. Seattle U saw their leading scorer Terrell Brown up transfer to Arizona, leaving junior Riley Grigsby at 9.7 points per game as their leading returning scorer.
Oh, Lord.
So should we talk about Oregon? It's UW starting the Pac-12, continuing its Pac-12 season
on
Saturday.
You're going to do a monologue on Oregon for a second here.
Against Oregon at 5 p.m. The Ducks were unable to start their season until last Wednesday due to the postponement of their scheduled opener against Eastern Washington. They traveled to Omaha, where Dana Altman formerly coached at Creighton, to play neutral site games against Missouri and Seton Hall. They lost their opener against Missouri before beating Seton Hall 83-70. Found out between those two games that the NCAA has improved the eligibility waiver for guard LJ Figueroa, a transfer from St. John's who will play a key role with junior point guard Will Richardson out 6 weeks after undergoing thumb surgery to repair an injury suffered in practice. As usual, the Ducks added heavily in the transfer market. In addition to Figueroa, they got wing Eugene Omoruyi from Rutgers. Omoruyi scored 31 points in his Oregon debut against Missouri. They added Duquesne transfer Eric Williams Jr., son of the former NBA player of the same name, along with former UNLV transfer Amori Hardy, a point guard, both of whom started for them, along with Omoruyi. Oregon brings back sharpshooter Chris Duarte, an NBA prospect, and project sophomore center Nfale Dante.
Well, on that note,
thanks for listening.
Thanks.